It's Thursday, June 30, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Just how do you answer the demands of justice, especially when it comes to one of the most complicated criminal trials in American history? And, of course, the largest Ponzi scheme ever exposed. In Wednesday's edition of the New York Times, there appeared a front-page article by Benjamin Weiser having to do with how the judge in that case, Judge Denny Chen, came up with his 150-year sentence. One of the things we repeatedly review is the fact that human justice is penultimate justice. That is to say, it can only go so far. In a fallen world, it is our responsibility to do everything we can to achieve justice. But in the end, perfect justice eludes us. That's why we're yearning for that world that is to come. And we're yearning for the perfect judgment that can be handed down only by the perfect judge. In the meantime, we do the best we can. We can certainly arrest someone who has committed the crime of drunk driving, and we can arrest him and hold him accountable in some sense for the damage that he causes. We can put him into prison, or we can, by tort litigation, take away money from him and give it to the one who is his victim, but we cannot heal the victim. We cannot bring the dead back to life. And we cannot bring the maimed back to health simply because we have a court of human justice that is trying to achieve justice. True justice is not merely the justice that assigns a punishment, but the justice that makes the wrong right. Well, that's what Judge Denny Chen just couldn't do. It was not within his power as a human judge in a human courtroom to bring healing to all of those who lost so much in the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme. Now, as it turned out, the internal thinking behind the judge's sentencing came down to the fact that the estimates are that Mr. Madoff, who was then age 71, would expect to live about 13 more years. In other words, he was not looking at the possibility that Mr. Madoff could actually serve 150 years, that was the sentence, but rather that he would serve more likely something like 13 years. The sentence that Judge Chen had come down to, in terms of what seemed to be most appropriate, was a 12-year sentence. That 12-year sentence would mean that Mr. Madoff could have thought that it was at some point possible that he could live longer than his sentence. In other words, it's very unusual in a white-collar crime, as is described here, a financial crime, not a crime of violence. It's very unusual for there to be what's effectively a life sentence handed down. But when Judge Chen handed down the sentence, it was not 12 years. It was 150 years. According to Benjamin Weiser's report in yesterday's New York Times, Judge Chen said he quickly rejected the idea of a 12-year sentence, Mr. Madoff, but he pondered whether 20 to 25 years might be acceptable. He ultimately concluded that even that, quote, would have been just way too low, end quote. Why? Well, because human sentences have more than one function. Certainly, that 150-year sentence is going to function to make a very clear point to Bernie Madoff, who has absolutely no hope of ever leaving a prison alive. But the real point of this, of course, was not so much to send that message to Bernie Madoff. One way or another, he was going to spend the rest of his life, or almost all of his life, if indeed he did live longer than the actuarial estimates, in prison. He was a ruined man. Everything financially will have been taken away from him. No, there were two other points that are very interesting to note. The first was that this judge wanted to send a message to the victims. He wanted to send a message to the victims that he took the crime against them seriously. Now, that's an interesting point, isn't it? That a human judge would decide to take the emotional state of the victims into account in sentencing. But we now routinely do that. That's now institutionalized in American jurisprudence. The second point is, and this is something very interesting to note, Judge Chen wanted to send a message to anyone who in the future might consider such a crime. That 150-year sentence serves as a very clear and graphic flashing neon light about the seriousness of this kind of financial fraud. Now, the fact that this story appeared in yesterday's edition of the New York Times indicates that it has taken some period of time for Judge Chen to be willing to talk about this quite openly. But at least Mr. Madoff has recently been speaking rather openly about his case as well. We now know something else that's kind of interesting. Bernie Madoff, it turned out, was not a horrible investor, at least not in terms of many of the decisions he made. Had he actually functioned as a legitimate investment manager, his folks might have come out pretty well. And it turns out that it looks like that those who are the conservators of this case are actually going to be able to recover more funds for the victims of this fraud than had previously been estimated. But still, it's going to fall far short of justice. Those who were harmed will not have all of their investments made whole. That's just to point us to the fact that this case, like every other human case, points us to the need for a judgment that no human court can give. In Romans chapter 8, Paul tells us that the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. Speaking of the judgment that is to come and of the kingdom of God and of the perfect justice that will be achieved under the reign of Christ, we are yearning for that. In the meantime, the best we can do is the very kind of logic that is reflected here in this front page news story, a logic about Judge Denny Chin, a judge in New York who simply did his job, and here in this news article tells us how he did it. The issue of same-sex marriage has been before us so often in recent years, and in recent months it has been so intensive, and of course in recent days has been unavoidable, given the action taken by New York State. But just when you think you've seen every argument, along comes something you haven't seen. Catherine Frank is professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia Law School, and she has offered a fascinating argument. She argues that gay persons may actually have lost something in terms of New York State's legalization of same-sex marriage. Here's what she writes. Here's why I'm worried. Winning the right to marry is one thing. Being forced to marry is quite another. How's that? If the rollout of marriage equality in other states like Massachusetts is any guide, lesbian and gay people who have obtained health and other benefits for their domestic partners will be required by both public and private employers to marry their partners in order to keep those rights. In other words, winning the right to marry may mean losing the rights we now have as domestic partners, as we'll be folded into this all-or-nothing world of marriage. Of course, this means we'll be treated just as straight people are now, but this moment provides the opportunity to reconsider whether we might force people to marry. Or that is, she says, whether we ought to force people to marry, whether they be gay or straight, to have their committed relationships recognized and valued. Okay, like I say, just when you think you've seen every argument, along comes a new one. Here's an argument coming from the homosexual left, arguing that the requirement now that persons be married in order to obtain the benefits generally given only to the married is going to be a new form of discrimination, a new form of limitation. So just when you thought the big battle was over same-sex marriage, it turns out that what many of us have been saying all along is really the case. This is really about eliminating marriage. In this article that appears in the op-ed column of the New York Times, this on Friday's edition from last week, here you have a major theorist and attorney arguing that what really needs to happen now is to eliminate all the special benefits that are given to marriage, no matter who gets married, heterosexual or homosexual. That reminds me of the fact that going all the way back several years, when the issue of same-sex marriage first came forward, Michael Signorile, a very prominent gay theorist, suggested that the real reason gays should demand same-sex marriage is to eliminate marriage, to marginalize it as an institution. Well, that is a very clear agenda, and now we know exactly where it leads. This article in the New York Times is not an established public policy, but the very fact that the article was written and given such a prime location on the op-ed page of the New York Times, the very fact that it is presented as a legal argument, well, that's exactly how these things get started. And you can count on the fact that this is an argument, even though you didn't expect it, that's not going to go away. Ashby Jones, by the way, writing in Wednesday's edition of the Wall Street Journal, points out that there are some very likely challenges to the question of same-sex marriage that are going to come in the courts, and they're going to come very quickly. And they're going to come, as Ashby Jones suggests here in yesterday's edition of the Journal, in a couple of very predictable ways. One has to do with something that is very like what the last article argued, and that is, do people actually have to get married to get these rights? Can they be forced to be married to get these rights? Ashby Jones also points out that there will be a necessary conflict right now and contradiction between the law of the land in terms of the United States of America and the law of the respective states where same-sex marriage may be legalized. That's not just attention. That's going to be a matter of rather significant importance for those who think they're married or are legally married, same-sex couples in states like Massachusetts and New York. How does that become a problem? Well, what about Social Security survivor benefits? What about some of the benefits that come to married persons by means of the federal law? What about immigration questions? These are live and pressing issues. You can count on the fact that there will be court challenges to these very quickly. Finally, on the issue of same-sex marriage, USA Today also yesterday ran a major editorial celebrating New York State's decision to legalize same-sex marriage. The headline of their editorial is, "Gay marriage moves forward, but acceptance is far from assured." One of the most interesting things that appeared in this article, however, is the suggestion that the First Amendment already guarantees that churches cannot be forced to perform same-sex marriages. Well, that's absolutely true. But the religious liberty issues having to do with same-sex marriage do not end with the church potentially being forced, if that's even the right word, to perform or to recognize a same-sex marriage. Now, the issue has to do with whom the church may hire, the kind of decisions a church or a church institution might make on admissions or employment or other questions. Non-discrimination law in many states is going to put many churches and Christian institutions in particular in the very awkward position of having to decide we can either live to our convictions or we can obey the law of the land. That's exactly what the founders of this nation sought to prevent in terms of the First Amendment. That's exactly what's at risk. That is why there were a good deal of questions about the laws that came together in New York, and why I will argue that all those assurances that those Republicans claim they got in the New York Senate bill will, at the end of the day, not suffice. There's another very interesting argument out there, by the way, having to do with marriage and religious liberty. It's the argument that's being made by many gay advocates that to limit marriage to a heterosexual couple, to one man and one woman, is indeed an imposition or an establishment of religion, because they argue the only argument that would support the non-legalization of same-sex marriage would be an argument deeply rooted in biblical religion, in particular in the Judeo-Christian heritage, in Orthodox Judaism, or in conservative Christianity, or if you extend the argument, also in Islam. Well, here's the problem. Let's just say that we buy their argument for a moment. Let's just say that we allow no religious input, no religious input whatsoever into the definition of our relationships. Well, there we have a problem, because the Bible also, having been eliminated, can't speak to an issue like polygamy. After all, why not polygamy? If there is no moral issue to it, and if they're here trying to bracket those moral issues, then why not? Or incest, at least among those who are consenting adults and will not be reproducing, perhaps in advanced age. Who can say that that's wrong if you say that there can be no religious input whatsoever into the question of marriage? Of course, that's nonsense. It won't work. It won't work anywhere. It never works. But nonetheless, that's an argument that is gaining traction in many sectors of our society. Eric Elkholm reported in Monday's edition of the New York Times that several states are now moving to legislation that will forbid abortion after 20 weeks. They are arguing that the existence of fetal pain at that critical mark of 20 weeks gestation, indicates that the child, the unborn child, is now a person deserving of constitutional protection, and thus the right not to be aborted, the right not to be murdered. Well, it's interesting to see the arguments that are now put forth by both sides on this. Mary Spalding Bouch, director of state legislation for the National Right to Life Committee, said this: "The purpose of this type of bill is to focus on the humanity of the unborn child. Fetal pain is something that people who are in the middle on abortion issue can relate to." End quote. Well, no doubt they can relate to it. But it's interesting. You have arguments coming from the other side with scientists saying there's absolutely no evidence that the fetus actually experiences pain at 20 weeks of gestation. Well, one of the things to note is that no one denies that a fetus, even at 20 weeks gestation, responds by withdrawing from a painful stimulus. What we have here, what we are facing, is an argument that is based on the ideology that abortion must be defended at all costs. Of course, this is where the abortion rights industry knows that it's in big trouble. If it admits or concedes for even a moment that even at 20 weeks of gestation, the unborn child is a person, then it's lost its ability to say that the child at any earlier point is not a person. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. This is the last daily edition of the first season of The Briefing. I want to thank you for joining me for these daily editions, and I want to ask you to do something for me. It'd be very helpful if you have a moment, if you would communicate with me what would make this most helpful. Over the course of this season, I think I've learned a great deal about how to address certain issues, and I've been looking at the news to try to determine what is most important for us to talk about. But if there's something you'd like to suggest, I want to tell you, I'd love to hear from you. You can just write me at mail@albertmoeller.com or go to albertmoeller.com, hit the mail button, and it will get to me. In the meantime, I hope the Lord blesses you greatly in the coming days, and I look forward to meeting you again in August for The Briefing.